Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for TWIT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, it's Denise Howell, and I'm here at On Hollywood in Santa Monica, California, at the Museum of Flying, a beautiful venue for us to consider the convergence of the entertainment industry and the technology industry. We're going to look at the state of online video and lots more interesting stuff at the conference today.
One of the questions is, well, okay, other than money, what is YouTube doing? And maybe I could turn it to one of the panelists. Perhaps, Alan, maybe you can give a little sense of what does YouTube do for Machinima and what don't they do?
Well, you know, I mean, I think if you're actually creating, you want to create video online, you've got to be involved with YouTube. I mean, one of the, you know, we have never seen a video platform on this planet that reaches 850 million people. It'll hit a billion people next year. And they're on every single device. They typically are on every single device before anyone else is on it. As you know, when you first bought the iPhone, the YouTube app was there, et cetera. So one of the things that really has made online video so disruptive is the fact that we are both global and multi-platform at the same time. So Machinima has 200 million people per month. Roughly 100 million of them are outside the United States. And then when the proliferation of all these devices came out, smartphones, tablets, connected TVs, that also created a part of the, you know, viral growth. So I think if you're looking for scale, massive numbers, YouTube is definitely, you know, delivers that. And of course, monetization allows you to create networks, which other platforms don't allow you to do. So there's a lot of benefit on that side. You know, in terms of like, where are we not right now? There's no subscription. There are a lot of transactions that are not actually happening on YouTube. So that's something that could happen in the future. As you all know, really healthy programming brands are dual revenue. You know, like ESPN has an advertising business, an affiliate business, or a form of a subscription business. So I think those kinds of things, you know, we all look forward to in terms of how the whole ecosystem grows. But from a getting to the audience perspective, you know, in a matter really of a couple of years, we've been around longer than that, but in a couple of years we've gone from 20 million to 200 million people that we reach, and there's just no other platform that comes close to that.
We're here at On Hollywood. I'm here with Alan Debevoise, who is the CEO of Machinima. Congratulations on winning the On Hollywood Company of the Year Award, Alan.
Oh, great. Well, I'm very excited about it.
Tell us a little bit about what Machinima does.
Well, Machinima is a online video company in the gaming category. We're one of the largest brands on YouTube. We reach about 200 million people a year, and I mean per month, and we deliver about 2.2 billion video views per month.
That's amazing. Yeah, we just finished up your panel, which was all about innovation in the world of online video. Really fun and interesting panel. Seems like YouTube is really still at the center of that universe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, YouTube reaches about 850 million people around the world on every device, in every country virtually. And so it's a real opportunity to build brands on top of that platform.
So I have a couple of follow-up questions from the panel. The more I listened to you guys, the more it seemed as though online video is part and parcel of the entertainment world and distribution, that what we think of as conventional television is going to exist side by side with the kind of thing that you're doing. So I'm wondering, how important is the living room to that whole experience, and how do you plan to get your shows in that arena?
I think the living room is still important. I think the way we think about it is, and I think also the traditional television networks think about it, is that it's a multi-platform world now. So people are watching video on smartphones, they're watching them on their iPads and other tablets. They are, you know, watching them on their computers. They do all sorts of things. And because of connected television, I think brands like Machinima and Vivo and other types of brands that are on YouTube and in the online world will actually get to the television set through connected television. So I think the next generation that grows up will think, I watch video wherever I want to, on whatever device I want to. And yeah, and sometimes I'm tired and I'm sitting in my living room and I want to watch, you know, Homeland or some great television show like Game of Thrones or whatever, or a show that would be from Vivo or Machinima or Hulu or Netflix. But sometimes you want to watch it on your iPad, on your smartphone. It really depends. Mm-hmm. So I think that the next generation of video brands will be kind of ubiquitous. They'll be everywhere. They'll be on demand whenever you want them, however you want them.
Is there one particular box or platform delivery system that you think is going to push that?
I don't think so, necessarily. I mean, I do think that, you know, we initially started almost everything that you watched when you watched a machine of a video was on a computer. And then, of course, the smartphones came about. Now we do almost a billion views a month in mobile. Mm-hmm. And that's growing incredibly fast. So I think the tablets and the smartphones are really a big part of that. Mm-hmm. And I think the next big wave for us is going to be the connected television. So I think really whatever device, wherever you are, you're on your Xbox, you're on your iPad or your TV set, we expect to show up there.
Right now, you guys exist in this world of sort of the Wild West, as far as law and regulation is concerned. The FCC doesn't regulate what you do at all. As what you're doing becomes more and more like conventional television programming, do you see that changing?
I don't really know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that evolves. I mean, I think we all sort of try to regulate ourselves in a way, and obviously there's, you know, the potential of doing things that are edgier in subscription models versus non-subscription models, I think, is clearly there. And we know that the television ecosystem works that way. HBO and Stars and Showtime are edgier than traditional broadcast television. So I think it'll probably follow similar patterns.
And have you been following earlier this year, both Pandora and Hulu have had some privacy lawsuits brought against them based on the way they're attempting to deliver advertising and tailor their content to their viewers' habits. Is this a concern for you at all?
I think, yeah, we have to be, you know, vigilant about this. I mean, we don't want to violate anybody's privacy, but we do also want to make the experience better for the consumer. So if they can opt into something that says, hey, I want, you know, things that I like and other people like the same things, can you recommend them to me? Like Amazon does that really well, and certainly YouTube does that really well. I think that's really a powerful part of the experience. I just think we have to leave it up to the consumer, right? I mean, the consumer has to be able to have some control of whether they want that or not.
Right. Well, Alan, it's great to meet you. Enjoy the rest of the show, and
absolutely,
congratulations once again.
Thank you. Thanks.
Take care.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Just, Mark, tell us a little bit. Put it in context. What percentage of all video is online? And you do a lot of work with the big broadcasters and such, with what I call more professional Pac-12, where I want to watch my football games.
So it's interesting, right? YouTube publishes a lot of stats about, you know, there are 10,000 years of video uploaded every single month, or some ridiculous number, right? But if we actually think about video consumption from a consumer's perspective, YouTube today is less than 2% of all video consumption. The vast majority of video consumption is still happening on television. In the U.S., online video is roughly 10%. In a lot of developing countries, it's less than 5%. And it's obviously growing incredibly fast. And so I think when we talk about interactivity, and everybody gets really excited about interactivity, the reality is that it's only a very small percentage of the global audience that's actually interacting with the content. When we talk about on-demand and we talk about video consumption patterns, the vast majority of people are still consuming content in a lean-back sort of fashion. Things are going to change, and I think because of the fragmentation of content, it's going to be important for consumers to be able to discover the content that they care about more efficiently. And I think we need to learn from television, which is you need to provide consumers a linear stream, because ultimately they want to lean back and they just want to sit down. But the linear stream needs to be context aware. So if they're on a mobile device, the type of content that should be recommended is very different from the type of content that they would normally watch on television. Same thing with the monetization models that you use. If you understand that the session is only going to be a couple of minutes long on an Android device, probably shouldn't show three pre-roll ads that are 30 seconds long.
Yeah, I don't agree with the linear stream idea at all. I think, in fact, if you see the most of you are probably going to your recorded things to watch, Homeland, et cetera, and you're recording them on a VOD basis. I mean, I think there's a place for linear and there's a place for VOD, but I think the vast majority of behavior is going to be more and more on demand than it's going to be by just watching passive linear streams. I think the interesting thing for everybody here and certainly in Southern California to keep in mind is, you know, a lot of times people are saying online video, whatever, I still watch a lot of television. But remember, those of you who remember when it was a crazy idea that there'd be an NFL football game on a cable network. And today, if you look at the Emmys and you look at what you're actually watching on television, whether it's Game of Thrones or HBO or AMC that's done an incredible job the last few years, cable has kind of really taken it to the broadcast world in terms of the programming that we watch. What's going to happen in the online world is that's going to happen, but it's going to happen way faster. And you're going to see huge consumption of brands like all the brands that are up here, shows and programming around the world that you'll be able to do from an online videos. And the next generation of people will not know the difference between a cable network, a broadcast network, an online network. It'll show up on their TVs, it'll show up on their iPads, it'll show up on their smartphones and PCs, on the Xbox or whatever the case might be. But it's a gigantic opportunity. Southern California is one of the big drivers of it right now on YouTube, and really I encourage everybody to really think about the opportunity that exists here with the type of talent that exists here in LA. You know, obviously, companies like Michael's that really help a lot of us with financing and getting capital to these companies. This is a natural ecosystem for this city and for this region.
Thanks for the plug.
I would just add one point is that I think we have to listen. What I'm seeing is the notion of on-demand is growing phenomenally on the cable,
right,
and online, and they're going to merge much quicker than what people think.
Right.
Because video on-demand is exploding in spite of the user interfaces that we have here in Los Angeles. You get out of LA, they're much better.
Right.
And people are using video on-demand, a lot of it free. But it's on demand.
I think it's not only on video on demand, it's IP delivery of video on demand, right, not cable. Yeah. I mean, my 6-year-old, granted, I look at my kids and sort of their behaviors. You know, he'll crawl in bed on Saturday morning, turn on the iPad, AirPlay it to the TV, he's watching his favorite shows from YouTube.
Exactly.
Right. So no one's involved.
Or Netflix, and it may be the same thing that they could find on Nickelodeon, but they're not going to Nickelodeon.
So one last point on the linear piece, because I truly believe in just all the stats and what we've seen, what Hulu has done and Netflix have done. So when you start watching the first episode of the first season of Breaking Bad, now they've actually turned that into more of a linear experience that at the end of that video, it automatically starts playing the next episode. And so that's what I'm talking about, really personalizing that experience. And so if we know who you are, we're actually going to try to create that linear experience because I was at Google when we acquired YouTube. And one of the primary reasons that they gave consumers the ability to select the next video was because bandwidth was expensive. They actually wanted to put roadblocks in front of the consumer. Now they're changing that because the economic model has changed.
We're here at On Hollywood, and I'm here with Bismarck Lepe of Ulyala. Hello, Bismarck.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Wonderful to chat with you today. I enjoyed your panel on innovations in online video. Tell us a bit about Ulyala.
So Ulyala is a video technology and services company. We work with large broadcasters and large online media companies to help them push their content onto all devices and then help them monetize it effectively. So we do everything from transcoding to storage to management, distribution to the analytics and the ad insertion that helps them build their businesses.
Do you also get them the advertisers, or do they do that themselves and then you take the whole package and put it together?
So we offer the tools so they can actually sell advertising into their content. In some cases, we will help them connect with the advertisers that will best monetize their content. But it's not just advertising. It's also subscription-based monetization and paywall monetization for pay-per-view.
All right. So you said you help them get on all kinds of devices. I assume you mostly mean mobile devices like phones and tablets. How are you addressing the getting the content into the living room issue?
So today we develop apps. We have template apps to make it easy for them to get their content on Samsung TVs, Sony TVs, LG TVs, but also some set-top boxes. So the most popular set-top box out there is Xbox, and so we make it very easy for their content to be transcoded once and then delivered out to all of those devices with the necessary DRM and the necessary monetization models that work for them. You know, for example, a very large broadcaster gets paid significant carriage fees from the operators, and so we need to authenticate with Adobe Pass to make sure that user is, you know, a subscriber of Comcast or Cox or DirecTV.
So are you the company who's behind, like I have Time Warner Cable, when I use their app and I'm watching their programs on my iPad, is that facilitated through you guys?
And not Time Warner Cable, but mm-hmm. if you go to the Pac-12, which is mm-hmm. recently launched, broadcast network that carries my alma mater's teams. We're the technology behind them. We're the technology behind Bloomberg. We are the technology behind ESPN as well.
Got it. What do you think about platforms such as Google TV, Roku? What else am I forgetting? How about just those two? Boxy is what I was forgetting.
So I think they're great technologies. Ultimately, if you're a content distributor, you need to be on them, but you also need to be everywhere else. Because the reality is that if you know, you look at Google TV, several million active users isn't really that interesting for a large agency that's trying to make an $8 million, $10 million buy. Like, they're still going to go to television before they go do an online advertising deal that's specifically targeting Google TV users.
On your panel, there was a lot of discussion of how it's going to be important for these brands distributing video, just like it is for television and cable networks, to have a lot of trust from their users, that users are going to trust them to deliver content they want to watch. Is privacy part of that equation for your customers? You know that Hulu got in trouble earlier this year and is being sued for the way that it was doing its metrics and analytics and sharing user data. How are you addressing that problem?
So today, over 200 million people watch a video on a new Yala-powered solution every single month. Mm-hmm. And so we get a tremendous amount of data flowing through our system. And we actually leverage that data to build better personalization and recommendation algorithms that drive higher engagement and better revenue for consumers. But we treat user privacy with kid gloves. Mm-hmm. So we keep user personally identifiable data completely separate from the behavioral data. And we'll take the behavioral data to create profiles that we then use to actually improve targeting, improve ad insertion, improve ad load.
Wonderful. So do you have folks in Washington that are monitoring privacy legislation? Are you doing any lobbying? Are you concerned about where that might go and what the FCC might ultimately do with online video?
So we do have high-powered and expensive lawyers, but we do leave the lobbying to the big boys, like my former employer, Google, and the Facebooks of the world.
Got it. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, Bismarck. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show here at On Hollywood.
Well, thank you.
Take care.
You know, I don't know. For me, like, the biggest thing when I started my company was to really focus on traction. You know, there are so many accelerators and companies out there starting today with everyone has a great idea and a PowerPoint. To get, you know, it's pretty easy to get 20 grand from Y Combinator or 500 Startups or another incubator and kind of run with an idea, but not really develop any, you know, users or revenue or metrics that are actually meaningful. So, you know, I think, you know, for me, it's focusing on being able to move the needle very, very early on. And as far as what I would do, I mean, you know, hiring talent is the biggest thing. So you really have to pay more attention than what you would think to hiring your team. I mean, for me, it was all through my personal network or the network of my investors. So I guess, you know, being more careful about bringing on in the early days.
My advice would be to make sure you're doing something you're passionate about. I sleep about maybe 2 hours a day at this point, where we're at, so you better love what you're doing. I mean, really love it. Like, be willing to give up the rest of your life, love it. And I think once you have that, everything else comes pretty naturally. My next piece of advice is you better execute. It really does no good to talk about something if you haven't actually done it. I had one VC look at me and say, I can't believe it. You did everything you said you were going to. Yeah, I did. You know, I mean, that's kind of, you have to actually hit those milestones. So set things that are realistic and make sure that you don't do anything outside of what has to be done to get to that next point, at least in the beginning.
Yeah, there was a great piece of advice. There was a guy, Scott McNeely, it's going to sound ancient, that founded Sun Microsystems. And you know, he went to, was an MBA at Stanford or whatever. And he was actually enticed to join the company by the original founder, which is Vinod Khosla, who's a famous guy now, billionaire. And he just said, you know, his advice, if you have a passion for an idea, is just to go for it because it doesn't really hurt. You know, you're not going to, you know, get killed or something doing it. But I would also echo Stephanie is that as an editor, you know, when I talk to aspiring entrepreneurs, their passion is just they want to be an entrepreneur and start a company, but they don't really have an idea of a company. And right away, I just look at them and I go, you know, go find your passion because, you know, just wanting to be an entrepreneur is not a passion. You know, you gotta, you know, it's gotta be a vision that comes from your real life experience in your heart.
I'm here with Tony Perkins. He's the founder of the Always On Network and the impresario of On Hollywood, where we are here today. Hi, Tony.
How you doing? Thanks for being here.
Great to see you again, as always.
Absolutely.
We were just talking a moment ago about education, and I'm wondering, you had a great speaker yesterday about innovation in education. Is my son going to go to college, or is he going to get his education online now?
Well, I think that's a good question. There are those in Silicon Valley, including the Peter Thiel, who was a valedictorian at Stanford, who was telling everybody not to go to college because it's a big waste of time. Mm-hmm. He, of course, gave Mark Zuckerberg Facebook his first $500,000, so he's done very well in his post-college years. His main point is that you walk out of college with a bunch of debt and no job. And it's better to try to get a job now. But I think there's obviously a role for education and there's a role for entrepreneurial education. We've seen a big proliferation of accelerators and incubators and things like that. So I think the future will be a mix of formal education, whether from incubators or universities, but a broadening of perspective. And hopefully online will open people up to better teachers and better content than they could normally afford.
So we're talking about education. That's one good example. The overall impression I've gotten from the panels I've heard here today is how online video isn't so much about just gaming and technology anymore, is it?
No, it's really interesting that YouTube could become the new network. I mean, they now have several partner channels that are getting, like Machinima, mm-hmm. And the music video site Vevo, who are actually getting substantially more original viewers every month than the top programming on television broadcasts. So I would say one of the biggest themes out on Hollywood is that the whole television broadcast, you know, video-oriented media world is going to be radically changed. Much in the sense, same way that music was radicalized back when iTunes first came onto the scene.
Really interesting point. Let's talk about the Rising Stars panel that was just on. They seem to emphasize the importance of hiring good talent.
Right.
Randy from Funny or Die was talking about how he was luring people over from the Hollywood side to work on the web video side by saying, you know, it's a wide open, unregulated world. You can do what you want. I guess that means for folks like Randy, too, they don't have to deal with the whole Hollywood system of talent management and unions and things. Mm-hmm. How's that all going to shake out?
Well, I think that we from Silicon Valley have to be humble. And just because we can, in a very cheap way, produce video, that content is still king. Mm-hmm. And I think that this community, you know, really has cut its teeth in a very competitive way, determining and betting on what is the content that can gain the widest market viewership. But I think about internet distribution and on-demand distribution changes a little bit the rules of those games in the sense that with television you only had a 24-hour window that you had to fill. With the internet, you have no such constraints and you have lower cost of production, so there's an opportunity to create content that can gain a respectable viewership of which you can earn money against. But at the end of the day, again, I think the talent of spotting content is one of the more artistic skills that, you know, your average Silicon Valley geek doesn't necessarily have.
Well, that's one of the goals of your conference here, isn't it? To bring together the geeks and the content creators and sort of find it if there's common ground between them. I've been to this event a few times in the past, and it's always seemed like there's been a real tension there. Do you think that that tension is as strong today?
Well, I think it's interesting because prior to Always On, when I was doing Red Herring, I used to produce an event called Herring on Hollywood. And, of course, the only interaction that was going on between Hollywood and Silicon Valley is that we had Napster and Kazoo allowing for everybody to steal music from this side of the world. But that being said, I think that the entertainment world, the established entertainment world, has faced up to the fact that the internet is the new and future form of distribution, and they better come to terms with that. And there is a lot of anxiety right now because they're trying to figure out how do they make that transition without cannibalizing their existing businesses. So, but as we know, wherever there's tensions, there's entrepreneurial opportunity. So I see a ton of entrepreneurial opportunity here down south, and we're glad to be here for that reason alone.
Well, we're really glad to have had the chance to talk to you, and thanks for putting on a great event.
Okay, and again, thank you for being here. On Hollywood would not be the same without you.
Thanks so much, Tony.
All right.
Take care.
All
right.
Please welcome Phil from Sony Electronics. Thank you for being here. So how fast is the, you know, would you say the adoption of 4K moving or will move?
So, you know, we've been investing in this 4K evolution that we're driving and bringing to market for quite some time now. I talked one time to you in the last event, actually, about 3D and what we've done with 3D.
Right.
And the starting point there was that we installed 3D projectors at theaters around the world, about 13,000 installations. So, you know, so that consumers could go to the theater and enjoy 3D content.
Right.
But those projectors that we started to market back in 2005 had a Trojan horse in there. We also equipped them with 4K resolution capability. So there's the starting point, 2005. We also brought along today our F65 cinematic camera. This is a true 4K camera. Actually, it's got a six megapixel camera in there, imager, I should say, to allow true 4K native content capturing. And we brought that to market in February 2011. So that's now out there as part of the foundation of 4K. And this IFA, we announced the 84K TV, the 4K, sorry, 84-inch 4K TV. So we've been seeding it for quite some time, and we're starting to see that movement, and we're stepping forward, and we're in a pretty good pace. But looking for many, many other parties to jump in and work with us on this.
So did any of these folks that were studios that were buying your 3D projectors, did they know that 4K was embedded?
At that time, yes. Clearly we shared with them because it was part of their investment as well as our investment. And they can see the power of 4K and the consumer attraction of having 4K resolution and movies in their theaters showing to consumers. So for sure, you know, they completely got it and understood it. And
you know, so how would you, I mean, we're a bunch of geeks, but how would you, so we understand the math difference, but how would you describe the difference between 3D and 4K?
So I should also mention our TV here is a, you know, it's a high definition TV, it's a 3D capable TV, it's an internet connected TV, as well as being 4K capable.
Right.
But I'll throw it back at you, Tony, because I know you were in our Palo Alto store not so long ago.
Yes.
I got a hotline call from the store. Tony's here, Phil, just to let you know. But you saw the 4K TV. What was your impression?
I was blown away, and it was kind of interesting because I happened to be at the mall with one of my dear friends, Alex Balkonski, who we grew up together in business. He was the 23-year-old founder of a company called C-Cube, which was a pioneer in MPEG technology. So he is a physicist and a graphics genius, as well as a guy that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars and buys all the latest tricks. And he was captivated and had never seen anything like it. I was watching the Spider-Man thing, amongst other great demonstrations that you had. And Spider-Man is my six-year-old son's favorite. That's what he's going to be for Halloween.
And he's got good taste.
Yes, he does. And just seeing Spider-Man jump around from building to building really blew me away. And at that point, I was starting to tell them that, you know, you really wanted me to be able to take it home to demo it, but they said it wasn't available to be taken home yet. So I'll try that trick again. But I think also you had the Philharmonic session, which I hope you have over here, because it demonstrated the audio, which I have to say, as an audio file, that I was impressed by that sound just as much as by the 4K picture. Yeah. So cheers on the whole thing.
We put together the whole package there. So, you know, to give a bit of depth to the conversation on this piece, the panel itself, the 84-inch panel, is not intelligent. What is really important is what you do with the actual processing engine and the algorithms that sit in that engine.
Right.
And I think Sony has a long heritage and history of being able to drive the best out of panel technology. So our product here is able to upscale Blu-ray discs to near 4K native quality standard.
Oh, wow, because there's a lot of Blu-ray stuff out there.
Yeah, there's about 7,000 Blu-ray titles available on the market. So if you have those titles, you buy the 84-inch, and I hope your friend buys it,
yes,
takes it home. He can really enjoy that experience at home. So one magic part from Sony is the algorithms and how we drive the panel. The other comes from our audio heritage, and you know, we put 10 speakers in this TV.
Oh my God.
And it will deliver a 5.1 surround sound field of sound to go with the immersive picture. So in combination, it's an incredible experience.
So I did notice that, and Alex did as well, that when you watch regular cable, you know, the image is only as good as what's being fed, and it was really the native content that was the most spectacular.
Yeah.
What are the plans in the content area? Because to really appreciate it, you know, you need 4K produced content. So what would be a content strategy?
So I think, you know, that's really the key. The native 4K content is the crucial component for maximum enjoyment of 4K TVs, our 4K TV, going forward. And there is content today in terms of short films that have been put together, beautiful films that are available. In Hollywood now, because we developed and produced and delivered the F-65 camera, there are 5 motion pictures that have been shot today in 4K native format using our F-65 camera. Oblivion is one, with Will Smith starring in that film. And those will start to come to cinemas in 2013. So that content is already being developed. We need, of course, more content going forward. We have the ability under Sony Pictures, under ColorWorks, to remaster content, whether it's from 35mm film or 2K content, and we can take it up again to very close to native 4K content, so the viewing experience is immense. So that content is there. the challenge will be how do we get that to the consumer's home?
Right.
So there are a lot of technical challenges that we need to break through. And I think with the innovators here from Silicon Valley, maybe that's something that we can get your contribution towards, because we don't have all the answers.
Hi, Phil. I'm Denise Howell. I'm a tech lawyer, and I host a show on twit.tv called This Week in Law. Uh-huh. I have a comment and a question. The comment has to do with your content delivery problem. You know, BitTorrent is an effective way to move around large files. It's something you might consider as a solution. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but maybe not. My question has to do with 4K as a proprietary platform. Is it something that you envision being, you know, we didn't have to begin with HD video on the net, and now we do.
Yeah.
Is that something you envision down the road? And also on the production side, is it something that small videographers are going to be able to leverage?
I believe so. This isn't proprietary, you know, Sony push. It's really for the market. And I mentioned the F65 camera on the professional side. Of course, we're marketing and selling that to all interested parties in Hollywood and also broadcast stations, etc. Because we want the 4K world to get off the ground and really start moving. We may be driving it, but we're giving people the tools to be able to create that. As we move forward, we'll bring other camera technology and other products that will make 4K content easier to produce and more prevalent. We see that as part of our mission. But it's not Sony proprietary.
Hi, folks. I'm here at Always On's On Hollywood. We just heard Phil Molyneux from Sony speak, largely about their new 4K television technology. There's one right here behind me. It's 84 inches. $25,000 and available for sale in early December. Now, Phil's been telling journalists that it's so immersive, you're going to fall right in. I haven't quite fallen in yet, but it's a very crisp picture and certainly an intriguing technology to watch.
In this new competitive world from both on-demand and internet and kind of fractured content, you know, where are the business models for all this?
We're figuring them out. We're trying to figure out best practices. I mean, I partner with Hollywood entities that are very used to traditional business models. They get a license fee for their content and a window. And so they come to me and my colleagues saying, hey, Xbox Live, your network, you got 67 million, pay us a license fee, we want to go to you. They go to Yahoo, they go to YouTube, they do the exact same thing. You know, our audience is gamers, and we're trying to hit scale, we're trying to grow that audience into a recognizable and monetizable audience so that we can, too, increase CPMs, so that we can adapt those models that they're used to. But on the content creation side, rather than just acquiring and licensing content, you know, what's great is that you've got production companies from the Telfas of the world who do the voice, who, you know, they don't want to give up format rights. So they come to us and say, hey, can we create the things that are, you know, like I said before, not the traditional time limit? Can we do a 5-hour show about DJs? You know, we're like, we could, you know. So we're figuring all of that out. But yeah, I mean, the expectations of the economics are from the old world, but yet we are literally every day we have very bright people trying to figure out, do we do what Glenn Beck did and charge for a channel? Do we, who sells the advertising within an app? Do we control it? Does someone else control it? And what about our Xbox Live Gold subscription, which we think is a great value for $60 a year, and you get such premium access to things? I wish I had the answer, but I do know that we don't see it as a problem. We see it as a huge opportunity because of all those things. But
so how do you look at the, like an HBO and the Showtimes are becoming known for the best TV program, and but it's also a higher production value, so they have to operate along a certain economic model.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, content is still king, you know, because that's what wins mind share. Is that all? Is the relationship between production value and ability to monetize it? Is that one of the difficult?
It's difficult. I mean, I'm coming from a division that makes Halo, and we put tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into these things, Gears of War, Forza. So we already have this high expectation of quality. And then my colleagues go out and go, I love Game of Thrones. I love The Walking Dead. Go make that. I want a pony. That's really nice. You know, I'd love to do that. But, for example, I just produced our very first live-action series called Halo 4, Forward Unto Dawn. We partnered with Machinima, actually.
Okay, cool.
And it's our fifth and final episode is this Friday. We're very excited. But the Halo game development team said, I want Spartans meets Band of Brothers. Go do that. And I wanted to create a character piece for like sub $1 million. I mean, I've got a protagonist who you don't see his face. Master Chief, you don't see his eyes. And we want to expand this audience and get not just the core gamer excited, but a new audience. But then I have a team who goes, ooh, I've got this $3 billion franchise. I'm going to write an $80 million script. So how do I go do that? But I did it, you know, and you've seen it in the press. It cost in the vicinity of $10 million, but I got New Media Guild rates, and I got great people. I got the production designer from the Pacific. I literally got Band of Brothers, basically, meet Spartan. But we have these expectations. The audience has these expectations. The quality of content that's being distributed through your platforms is amazing, you know, and so we have to figure out how we create a portfolio of content that we can sell against, because the business model historically has been put it in a box, sell it at Best Buy, and we can project the units and we're done. Now it's digital distribution, and we got to figure out how we sell ads against it to a new audience in a different way, and how do we keep that production quality that my fanboy colleagues at times say I want. We just hired Nancy Tellum from CBS to build an LA studio, and she's going to bring to the table some amazing partners from her experiences in TV. They're not cheap.
Right.
And the last point I'll make is that, you know, what it costs for Game of Thrones for $7 million an episode now, half of that budget now has to go to interactivity and tech and headcount. And so your dollar, your checkbook doesn't stretch as far, and now we got to create a portfolio. It's going to be hard.
I'm here at On Hollywood with Jenna Seiden from Microsoft Studios. And Jenna has what she calls, and I think we all might agree, is the next network over there at Microsoft being distributed on the Xbox. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about the programming you're doing at Microsoft Studios.
Well, we are engaging on a new entertainment strategy. We are looking at the Xbox platform, not as a gaming platform, but as an entertainment platform. And I represent the division that creates original content. And so my history is in Halo and Gears of War and taking those IPs and trying to create linear TV content, TV-like content, or interactive TV content. So it's content like that, plus working with external partners from the traditional worlds of TV and film who want to just get their content on our platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at a portfolio that is a combination of our own IP, of things coming in from third parties, and figuring out how to offer that up to our core audience, which is our 67 million sort of gamers that made us who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So our programming strategy is in development, I'd like to say, but it's going to focus on that core gamer originally coming from us, from external parties. We're also doing live streaming of events, again, focused on that core audience. And so we're just trying to figure out exactly what is that mix of scripted content, reality content, live events, plus, you know, these special interactive versions of all of those things. So we brought in Nancy Tellum from CBS to really help us with this entertainment strategy to look across all of Xbox and figure out how we marry everybody who's touching entertainment content.
So you have shows like The Guild. Is that still one of your
we
shows?
We used to have The Guild.
Ah, okay.
No, but The Guild was a great early example mm-hmm. of content that our audience loved.
Mm-hmm.
It was sponsored by Sprint. We didn't produce it. Felicia Day and her team did.
Mm-hmm.
But it was hard to find. It was by itself. There was no portfolio. And it sort of inspired us to say, we need more of this type of content that we need to oversee. We need to curate more of it. And so The Guild was a great example. I think it had 4 or 5 seasons of it.
Mm-hmm.
I may have been responsible for canceling it.
We're sorry to hear that. Felicia's a good friend of the network.
No,
we'll
she's one. It was because she deserved better,
yes.
To be completely honest. And we really wanted to give her a platform to reach
mm-hmm.
people. And no one was being able to find it. And so it was a hard decision because no one knew how to make that decision. And it came to me. And I just started. And I went, this is really hard because I love her. I'm a fan of her work.
Yes.
And it's great. But it was a great example to say, hey, you're using it as an example all the time. she deserves a portfolio and neighbors and other people to, you know, keep them in this ecosystem. And so the Guild was something we did. We've had other ventures in scripted content before, but not really from an organized standpoint. And now we're really committed to, you know, doing that thanks to what we just produced for Halo, which is a web series with Machinima. Mm-hmm. And it's gone really, really well that they brought in, like I said, Nancy to go, hey, let's do it right this time, because we've had a lot of fits and starts. Right?
Yeah. Tell me, you've also got National Geographic recently coming on board, right? Mm-hmm. And Sesame Street.
Yes.
How is the experience of watching that on Xbox going to differ from what you might see watching their content on TV?
Well, you're going to see the traditional Nat Geo episodes, and you're going to see traditional Sesame Street videos, but with an Xbox spin to it. Mm-hmm. We leveraged existing content and produced some exclusive content on top of some of those episodes so that the Kinect camera can recognize you, mm-hmm. it hears you, and it allows you to engage in the content in a really great way. Now, mind you, National Geographic and Sesame are wonderful brands and focus for a younger audience, but it helped us build muscle to figure out what are those interactive experiences, talking to Grover on the screen, throwing coconuts into a box, and getting kids who are more interested in jumping it off the couch to engage, whereas an adult, we want to lean back a lot. We're not ready to totally engage, but it was a great experience for us in two ways. One, to start to figure out how we take those interactive features and add them into more mature content for the core gamer. And then second of all, from a business standpoint, because it's more like the products are being distributed on a disc on the shelf, we are now going to be trying to do those things digital distribution. And so it taught us sort of episodically, you know, can we release things like this, like the downloadable content for like Halo and things of that nature. So those are great experiences with great partners, with great experts in physical production that we don't have. We know how to make games. We need those partners like Nat Geo and Sesame Street who are willing to pioneer, hold our hands with us, teach us how the production pipeline goes, and it was a wonderful experience, and those products are out there. Mm-hmm. Great.
So we have an Xbox in our family.
Good.
And we
good
have
here.
A bunch of Kinect games.
Great.
Two of the earliest ones being Kinect Adventures, right? Everybody
Kinect Adventures, Kinectimals,
and,
yeah.
And yes, we have Kinect
Sports.
We have Kinect Sports, and we have Dance Central and some of the
I've
dancing
I've been
ones.
Working out to Dance Central 3 since it came out a week or two ago. It is awesome.
So with all those games, I've always been sort of surprised and delighted, and of course you're just embarrassed as anything when you're mm-hmm. doing the game and it's filming you. And you get those
it
funny
is,
little
it
snips.
It tells you. It's not Big Brother.
No. Where I'm going with this is I'm wondering,
know.
You know, of course, with full disclosure and consent on the part of your users.
Of course.
If you have any plans to start using any of that
UGC
funny content in your programming.
We believe in UGC, and we believe in the audience engagement, since that's what really differentiates us, is our ability to engage the audience in ways that other platforms can't.
Uh-huh.
So in our thinking about the types of content we want to create, from the games to the TV-like shows that we're going to create, that is absolutely very important to us, because that's our community. We want them to feel involved and have that social experience, so, but we're going to make sure that we have any, you know, disclaimers
right.
We're never going to use that unless it's approved and they've consented to it. But that type of content is fun and it's creative and it's just something special that no one else can do that we can with the Kinect camera and that we can do now on all of our other platforms. So it's absolutely one of the variables in the equation for all the content we want to create.
Right. Yeah. One of the things you mentioned in your panel that I found really interesting was the concept of sort of a traditional Hollywood mm-hmm. pricing model for talent and
right.
production moving into the world of new media production. We heard Randy from Funny or Die earlier talking about how he was luring people over from Hollywood by saying, come on over to the new media side where you have a lot more freedom and our costs are lower. And you used the term new media guild rates.
Yes.
How is that working?
I use New Media Guild rates for this one, for this one project, our Halo series that's on Machinima, Forward mm-hmm. Unto Dawn. You know, there's a big divide between the economics of Hollywood and the traditional models of how talent that Randy spoke to and that I used to represent as an agent got paid. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for these new platforms to distribute content on, but they're expecting the same paychecks, they're expecting the same treatment. And it's not that we don't want to do that, but our business model is different. And our rules are different. We're not constrained by, like we talked, day parts, and you can create whatever you want. We don't have those same types of ratings or parental controls to the extent of like TV 14 and things like that. So New Media Guild Rates is, and I'm speaking on behalf of an industry that's created this so that it fosters the protection of talent in this new space. So there are, for the Writers Guild, they get paid a certain amount for TV, they get paid a certain amount for film. But now that things can be distributed on the internet, the guilds have set up rules to protect them. They set up the New Media Guild Rates to encourage production in my space and in others, but it's still very experimental. And what that allows me to do is entice top talent to come work at more manageable rates for me, because I'm not getting the hundreds of millions of dollars for game production. I'm sort of, it's an experiment. So the New Media Guild Rates allows me to create content at reasonable budgets, at pay scales that I can afford, but that still protects the talent with their pension and health. There are certain rules that I'm not an expert in, how long it has to be on a platform before it goes to TV or film, but we are very respectful of that. But hopefully other companies really take advantage of those systems so that great talent can work with us or work with the internet and sort of have the freedom to do things. Because otherwise, if it's abused, I think it's going to hurt everybody who has the way to reach these millions of people if they abuse these rules that are set up to protect them.
Right.
Yeah, so it really helped us get great talent for our Halo series. We got a fantastic line producer who was usually very, very expensive, but he knew he needed to grow his skills, and he worked with Guillermo del Toro. And he cut his rate normally, but he didn't have to because those were part of the New Media Guild rates. And he said, I need this experience. I need to grow my resume. I want to work on this. Same thing with our production designer, et cetera, our writers. Mm-hmm. Writers from Spartacus and Smallville. It really allowed us to bring top talent to our platform and not sacrifice quality.
Right. And in this economy where people are looking for work, it seems like a way that people can feel good about the work they're doing in new media without feeling like they're going beyond their unions or what have you.
Yeah, no, we are, you know, Microsoft, most video game publishers are not signatories to any guilds, and that's not my decision. Those are other decisions from other people. But we want to be respectful of all the rules and regulations, and as we grow into this new space, we have to learn best practices, and we have to figure out how to do that. So it was very important to me and my production team to make sure we could go to any lengths that we could to do it by the book. And that's just who we are. It's who I am, and that's what Microsoft has to do, but there's no question there.
That's great. Well, Jenna, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you.
We're with Jenna Seiden from Microsoft Studios here at On Hollywood.
Thank you.
I'm here at On Hollywood where I've found a fellow lawyer type, David Hernand, at Cooley. And Cooley's new office here in LA is working in the technology and innovation arena, and David is right at the ground floor of that. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to have you here.
So I wanted, you know, since you're another lawyer person at this conference about the convergence of technology and entertainment, I'm wondering where you think we've come from the Napster days. You know, is there still kind of a head-to-head competition between the two industries, or are they able to coexist peacefully now?
I would say a little of both, or somewhere in the middle. It's not that they're coexisting peacefully in the sense that the new business models really threaten the old business models, but Hollywood learned an important lesson from what happened to the music industry, that you need to embrace technology, embrace the new models, and so they are trying to do that. You see that with Hulu, where they're experimenting with an online model to make their content available outside of their traditional windows and the traditional big screen. But at the same time, there's many in Hollywood who are very concerned about the big audiences that are showing up for the second screen and that ultimately threaten to take away eyeballs from the big screen.
I've only been here this one day at the conference, but what I haven't heard, I've heard a lot of enthusiasm about going forward in online media from all ends of the spectrum, the people doing the production, the people doing the technology that make it possible. I haven't heard a lot of people voicing a lot of concern about privacy or the fact that, you know, if we come out with this new wonderful form of DRM to wrap our very high definition video around, that of course it'll be instantly cracked, but nobody seems too worried about that. Do you think we're just not hearing those voices here today, or that it's less of a concern?
I think it still remains a huge concern, but companies, particularly companies that are getting venture financing, they understand the rules of the road. Mm-hmm. They understand that they need to have an effective DRM system in place in order to be taken seriously, in order to not be sued out of oblivion. The music companies did a very good job of scaring everyone when, in response to Napster and Kazaa, they went after a bunch of those companies, and it was very painful. I think you saw what happened with, was it Vio? Mm-hmm. They had the significant litigation there, that everyone who's playing in this space understands they can have a new model, but they got to find a way to do it legally.
All right. Well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. I hope you've enjoyed the event.
Thank you very much.
Nice meeting you.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Take care.